This morning's passage is from Luke 10, verses 38 to 42. As Jesus and his disciples were on their way, he came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. She had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he had said. But Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made. She came to him and asked, "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Tell her to help me." "Martha, Martha," the Lord answered, "you are worried and upset about many things, but few things are needed, or indeed, only one. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her."
So we are just past the halfway mark in the season of Lent. And I thought I'd ask this morning, how is it going? A few weeks ago, we began this 40-day journey leading up to the celebration of Easter. And we talked about how Lent is a time of kind of spiritual exploration for people who faith might be kind of something a little outside of their comfort zone. We encourage people to really make a concerted effort leading up to Easter to think about it and ask some questions and seek God. For those who have already, you know, begun that journey and are along it, it's a time of trying to focus ourselves in for a season, again, up to the celebration of Easter. And so here we are halfway through, wonder, you know, maybe people have decided to kind of set it aside, or maybe it seems like it's dragging on, or maybe it's just going by quickly. I saw this image and I thought I'd share it with you. Halfway point. Please stay on the trail. And it's an encouragement for us that we're halfway there and the journey continues. And this morning we'll talk a little bit more about the journey that Jesus was on as an encouragement and a reminder for us to continue pressing on. Our reading this morning, it comes from chapter 10 of Luke's gospel. But something significant happens in chapter 9 that I don't want us to skip over too quickly. Now, you've probably heard about this, even if you haven't read the book or heard that there was a book, this idea of having like a word for your life for a year. You've kind of heard about this. People say like, my word for the year is thankfulness, or my word for the year is hope. And then you kind of try to bring yourself back to that word. So these people wrote a book and it's called One Word That Will Change Your Life. Apparently there is a word meant for you, and when you find it, live it and share it, your life will become more rewarding and exciting than ever. And this idea of having a word, and I think there's actually some wisdom in that. I can see that being significant. They're coming out with a new book, which takes it to the next level, where you can find out your life word. So now there is a word for your life, and then you just follow that for the rest of your life. Now, most likely, Jesus wasn't focused on a word. He probably didn't have a single word that was in front of his mind, but he was focused. He was intensely focused on something significant. And we find out what that was in Luke chapter 9, verse 51. As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. One of my wife, Melissa's favorite questions, sometimes when we're sitting around with friends or every time we go on a trip somewhere, she says, "What is one place in the world you want to visit?" And sometimes she'll be gracious and she'll give you two chances. You know, you can name two places. You don't have to pick just one. And for me, I think Jerusalem, or like Israel, would be one of those places I would love to be at some point in my life. It's a very dangerous place, which complicates things. But it would be a place, it would be quite an amazing experience to, again, walk in these places that we read about in the Bible. I would be there almost purely as a tourist. So Jesus had this intention, this focus to get to Jerusalem, but not as a tourist. Going to Jerusalem was something that would have been expected of Jews during certain high points of their season. And he had certainly been there before. But this wasn't just about going to see the sights. This was something much deeper for him. Different translations of the Bible translate this phrase, he was resolved to go, he resolvedly set out to Jerusalem, slightly differently, but they all kind of come together to paint a picture of how significant this was for Jesus. One version says he was determined to go to Jerusalem. Another, he moved steadily onward toward Jerusalem with an iron will. The message expands it further. He gathered up his courage and steeled himself for the journey to Jerusalem. The New King James, probably the closest to the Greek, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. All of these words trying to express how significant this was for him and how committed, ultimately committed, he was to get to Jerusalem. This verse marks a significant turning point in Luke's narrative. And from this point on, much of Jesus' teaching turns to his disciples. He has set his mind. He's going to Jerusalem. Something significant is going to happen there. And in chapter 9, he reveals to his followers what that thing is going to be. The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law. And he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. This is what Jesus was focused on. This is why he resolutely set out for Jerusalem. It was definitely not what his followers had in mind. They tried to steer him away. They tried to change his mind. Well, if that's what's going to happen there, then let's pick another destination. Plenty of other cities that you could go and bring this message, this good news to. But he wanted them to understand what it meant to be a follower of his. In chapter 9, verse 23 and 24, Jesus said to them all, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me will save it." When a would-be disciple asks for just a quick moment to go and say goodbye to his family, Jesus clarifies the cost of following him. He says, "No one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for service in the kingdom of God." I mean, we read this, it seems like Jesus is callous. Like, how can he not understand the significance of that? He's calling people to follow him, and the person, they simply say, "Can I just say goodbye to my family?" And Jesus is like, "No." But he wasn't being a jerk. He was just letting them know that this idea of following me, it's not easy. You can't just follow me because I'm the popular guy around town right now. If you're following me, you have to be willing to lose everything along the way, including that family of yours. Jesus was focused. He was on a mission that would not be for the faint of heart. While everyone was marveling at all that Jesus did, he said to his disciples, "Listen carefully to what I am about to tell you. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men." But they did not understand what this meant. He was trying to tell them that something significant was going to happen in Jerusalem and that was where all of his energy was going to be focused from this point on. But they didn't understand. And so, without fully understanding why they had to go, they followed him on to Jerusalem, which is where our reading this morning picks up. As Jesus and his disciples were on their way to Jerusalem, were on their way to the cross. While they were on their way, he came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. A couple of weeks ago, our youngest son Jude turned 12, and we threw a little birthday party for him. And the party, this is one of the interesting things. If you're a parent and you're throwing birthday parties for your kids, if you're going to start the party around the dinner hour, try to make it obvious whether dinner is included or not, right? You ever like get that invitation? The party starts at 5:30, and you're like, are they going to feed my child or not? I'm not quite sure. So we said, well, let's make it obvious. We're going to start at 6:30, right? Like, clearly they're thinking you're not going to wait kids to wait until after that to eat dinner, right? So we thought that's going to make things clear, and then we had some events planned for later on. Well, 10 to 6, the doorbell rings. 10 to 6, the doorbell rings. We're like, who is this? Like, we're finishing up dinner, we're setting the table, and here one of the kids, one of Jude's friends, shows up. Dad's at the door. He's like, "Hey, yeah, so thanks for having him. You know, bye," and off he goes. And we're like, we haven't eaten a dinner yet. So his friend comes in, and it was actually really funny because he was oblivious to the fact that he was 40 minutes early. He just sat down and enjoyed a nice meal of like some grilled sausage and noodles and carrots. And maybe afterwards he was thinking, that's the weirdest like birthday party dinner I've ever had. And maybe he thought about the fact that he was actually the only person there at the dinner table with our family. I don't know. Most people don't like surprise guests. It throws us off. And Martha was one of those people. She didn't maybe really like surprise guests. The story goes on. Martha had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he had said. But Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made. Now, it's important to note here that there were a lot of preparations to be made. That is something that we hear in this passage. There were a lot of preparations to be made, and she was taking care of them. She wasn't making work. It's not like she didn't want to be around Jesus. It's not like she couldn't have sat there and listened, but there were things that she needed to do. You can't exactly fault her in this, although we kind of like to, but it would have been terribly rude to have no food to serve. Maybe if the place was a mess, it would have been kind of rude to have guests in your home like that. So she's going around busying herself up. So there are preparations that had to be made, but there's a warning in there for us as well, a warning to consider our priorities. The Bible says that she was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made, which means that there was something that she should have been focusing on that she wasn't able to. She was distracted. Her mind was occupied with other things instead of the thing that was really most important at the time. What's the first thing that you do every morning? First thing that probably most of us do every morning is check the time. Maybe on your phone, maybe on a clock. What time is it? What do I have to get up yet? How much time do I have until I have to leave the house? Like trying to measure out our day right from the beginning. 300 years ago nearly, in the novel Gulliver's Travels, the Lilliputians decide that Gulliver, this giant who that comes across them, consults his watch so often that it must be his god. Well, he keeps looking at this thing, so it must be his god that he's so focused on this clock. Wow. I mean, if Gulliver was checking his watch a lot, how about us in our culture, right? Our society is so fast-paced, and part of it because we have to. I mean, I came up with this, or I found this image here, to-do list, everything. Like, that's most of our day, right? What do I have to do today? I have to do everything. That's what I have to do. But things get so fast-paced that we constantly feel like we're falling behind, like we need to pick up the pace just in order to stay in the game. Larry Dossey came up with this phrase that he called time sickness and defines it this way, as the obsessive belief that time is getting away, that there isn't enough of it, and that you must pedal faster and faster to keep up. And many of us suffer from time sickness. Now, there are people who come up with creative solutions to this, such as the author of this book, 1 Minute Bedtime Stories. You know, your kid's going to demand a story, but you don't have to waste 5 minutes. You don't have to waste 5 minutes of your evening telling the story. You can get it done in a minute. And if you're really creative, you can get it done even quicker. Check this out. I came up with some really quick ones here. Your kid, Mom, read Harry Potter to me. Okay, here's a story. Harry Potter says, I thought I was a lonely child. Instead, I'm a wizard. Hagrid, Harry, here are some secrets I'm not supposed to tell you. And then Harry saves the world. The end. Thanks, Dad. Tuck them in. You can get quicker than that. Where the wild things are, you can do this one in under a minute. Once there was a boy who wanted to have adventures with wild things. He discovered that if he used his imagination, instead of pestering his parents to read to him, he could do just that. The end. My favorite, Clifford, the big red dog. Emily Elizabeth, I have a big red dog. The end. I'll leave copies of this in the lobby. If you would like to, you know, it's crazy. I mean, but we all want to find time, find ways to save ourselves time, to make things move along quicker. But as you think about it, I mean, someone who would try to tell a story this quickly, I mean, busyness can eat away at our souls, and it can really distract us from what matters most. Sometimes it actually pushes over into the point where we're so busy that we just can't even imagine going on. I was listening to talk radio on the way into the office one day this week, and they were talking about the UW student who died by suicide last week. And they were talking specifically about this letter that his 16-year-old younger brother had written and posted on Reddit. If you haven't read it, sorry, if you haven't read the article, like, it's powerful. This 16-year-old kid writing, just lashing out in anger at this world that put so much pressure on his brother that he would think that ending his life was the only option. And as they were talking about it on the radio, the host said that, you know, one of the root problems here, and of course it's complicated, suicide is very complicated, but one of the root problems in this is how our culture glorifies busy. And they were talking about how everything, there's so much pressure on us to do more and do it faster and get it done quicker. And there's no such thing as just stepping back. And that's what the 16-year-old, the wisdom in the 16-year-old's letter is like, if you are struggling with this, then just like leave school. You don't have to do this. You don't have to give in to the pressures of time right now. It's not worth it. And there's wisdom in that. Martha came to Jesus and asked, Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Tell her to help me. Tell her to help me. I'm doing what matters. Tell her to help me. All of a sudden, Martha's self-importance gets the best of her. And this is something that we, I think, all are subject to at different times, thinking that busyness makes us important. Eugene Peterson, a pastor and author, writes that the word busy is the symptom not of commitment, but of betrayal. It is not devotion, but defection. And he's writing in this passage specifically to pastors, so I'll keep reading for a minute. He says, the adjective busy, said as a modifier to pastor, should sound to our ears like adulteress to characterize a wife, or embezzling to describe a banker. It is an outrageous scandal, a blasphemous affront. It's one of the more challenging things that I've read in considering my own calling and my own vocation, but don't think that the rest of you get off that easy. Just because he was talking to pastors, I think that this is wisdom for all of us. That if we think that busyness symbolizes our commitment, that it symbolizes our devotion, that we should be challenged to consider that perhaps it's actually more a symbol of a betrayal or a defection from what matters most. Thomas A. Kempis wrote many years ago, it is in disordered loves and empty fears that all disquiet of heart and distraction of mind have their origin. When the things that we love, when we love them in the wrong order, that's when problems come. Again, the things that Martha were doing, she had good things to do, but she got the order wrong. Now recall Jesus' response to the prospective followers who wanted to, in one case, bury their father before they followed him, in another case, say goodbye to their family before they followed him. Those things aren't wrong. Those are good things, actually important things to do. There was just something better, Jesus was trying to say. Martha, 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 the Lord answered. You are worried about many things, but only one thing is needed. Down on through the years, from Jan and Marcia Brady to Edith and Mary to, well, any combination of the Kardashian girls, there's nothing like a good rivalry between sisters, right? And this is what we have in this story, is this rivalry between two sisters. And then Jesus just totally takes sides. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her. Like Martha's thinking that she's being the good host, she's taking care of the hospitality here, she's being the good one, and all of a sudden Jesus completely flips it. Not only does he say, like, hey, you're both doing something important, he says, actually, your sister's doing something better. Just like that. Talk about taking sides. There's a great book that an author named Gary Thomas wrote a number of years ago called Sacred Pathways. It's a really interesting one, and he talks about how kind of all of us have different pathways that help us connect with God the most meaningful. And two of them are actually kind of characterized by Martha and Mary. One of them is a category of people he calls caregivers. And you would say that caregivers serve God by serving others. And you may say, yeah, that kind of sounds like me. I feel kind of close to God when I can serve other people and take care of people. This is Martha, right? This is what she's doing. She thinks the most important thing in that moment is to be busy about the house. So another of these sacred pathways would be the contemplatives. Thomas writes that these Christians seek to love God with the purest, deepest, and brightest love imaginable. Their way of connecting with God is just sitting and listening. And so here Mary is this contemplative. And there are certainly other pathways. And I think one of the things that Thomas is trying to point out in his book is that we all connect with God differently. And that it's not about one path being more spiritual or more valuable than others. And yet there's something that Jesus says that contradicts that just the slightest bit. Because he says that what Mary's doing is better. That this idea of just being with me is actually, in this case, better than serving. And it reminds me of this verse that we've been coming back to over the course of the last year from Revelation, where Jesus gives this message to be sent out to one of the first century churches. And he says, I know your deeds. I get it. You're doing lots of good stuff. That's great. But the problem is that you're forsaken your first love. And this idea of, like, there are lots of good things that we can be doing, and there are lots of ways that we can be pursuing God and faith, but God also wants, he wants to always bring us back to this spending time with him, this first love, this contemplation, and the relationship that we have to develop. See, as much as Martha hated to hear it, Jesus had to tell the truth if there was any chance of her getting her priorities straight. As difficult as it is for us to hear it, we need to hear the truth. As one author puts it, truth consists in the mind giving to things the importance they have in reality. We want the truth. We don't want to waste our lives doing things or believing things that don't actually help us get to where we want to go. We want to know the truth. And so when I go back to that radio segment, and they were talking about it, what is the solution? And the host went on to say that we can learn a lot from Buddhism, she said, which encourages us to focus on the present moment. And preparing a sermon on this theme, this conversation between Martha and Mary, I said, you don't have to go to Buddhism. It's right here. Jesus is saying that we need to do this, that you need to just be present. Martha, there's lots to do, but just be present. I'm here. Be present with me in this moment. This is what matters the most. My wife has a saying that she uses when our kids, maybe we're watching a show together and they open their phones and fiddle around, or maybe we're playing a game and they're checking their phone. She says, be present when you're present. And I came across this great device that you could make at home if you want. Here, this easy instructions. Open the box, insert phone, close lid, and be present. So you can just make this and keep it like on the table at home and just put the phone in there and then be present. This is what Jesus is inviting us to, being present with him, not allowing every other thing in the world to distract us. Here we have Mary taking on the role of a disciple by sitting and listening. Catherine Duck Doherty, an author about the spiritual life, reflects on her observation of a hermit that she met, a hermit being someone who intentionally removes themselves from other people, lives like maybe in a cabin out in the woods somewhere, and really interacts with people only very minimally. And she writes that his human horizons were somewhat limited so that his spiritual horizons could grow without distraction. I want to read that one more time. His human horizons were somewhat limited so that his spiritual horizons could grow without distraction. Might we need to find ways to limit our human horizons so that we can focus on God? I get the impression that this is precisely what was going on with Mary. See, as much as our society exalts the productive life and rewards the productive life, when I think about people who exemplify the spiritual life, I never get the picture of a hurried, frantic individual. And I try to remind myself of that when I'm hurried and frantic. Am I someone who is pursuing God in all of this? As one author writes, no matter how hard you try, you cannot accelerate enlightenment. Sometimes you need to just slow down, sit at Jesus' feet, listen, be present. In the few verses before the ones that form our reading this morning, Jesus says to his closest followers in Luke 10, 23 and 24, he turned to his disciples and said privately, "Blessed are the eyes that see what you see. For I tell you that many prophets and kings wanted to see what you see but did not see it, and to hear what you hear but did not hear it." You've been given a gift to be present with me, he's saying. All of us have been given that same gift, to be present with Jesus. We need to receive that, to remove our distractions and listen. Along our own journey to the cross, not only during the season of Lent leading up to Easter, but all along our lives, as we resolutely set our faces to Jerusalem, each one of us needs to find a way to slow down enough to be present with Jesus and to choose what is better. I'm going to invite you to stand, and we're going to kind of close our time together with a song of response, and then I'll pray and formally wrap up our time at this portion of our service.